And welcome to another edition of Amana Podcast. This is our ninth podcast. Amana is a collective of people, places, things, and actions that transcend us and living through your higher virtues. And today it's my great pleasure to introduce Grant Doyle. Welcome, Grant.
Thanks, Mark. It's been a long time. Have you done well?
Yeah, it's Grant and I have known each other, oh my gosh, since we're teenagers, as you can tell, another Aussie with the accent, and but became better mates in our 20s, probably as he moved to the United States, and we're both from that tennis world. So, Grant, tell us a little bit about your tennis background, how you got started in Australia, and we'll riff from there.
Yeah, we actually had a tennis court in our backyard growing up. I grew up in a place called Glenfield, which is about an hour southwest of downtown Sydney. Mm-hmm. So we had a court in our backyard. It was actually an old, we called it loam in Australia, but it was a pretty nice clay court. And, I used to just take lessons once a week. I didn't really take tennis too seriously, honestly, till I was, I'd say probably 11 or 12 is when I really started to, you know, kind of play, you know, 5-6 days a week, and then start doing training and that kind of stuff. But yeah, I've been doing that since then, really. So I'm 47 now, so it's 37 years. So it's been a long journey. I obviously played junior tennis in Australia, and then around about 14, 15, 16, started traveling, playing overseas, and then played on the ITF tour, and then transitioned to the ATP tour. I played on ATP tour for about eight or nine years. And then, funny enough, I started coaching after that, after meeting another friend of ours in Los Angeles. And I've been coaching ever since.
So going back into that young time for you, what did you either like about tennis? What drew you to tennis? What did you care about?
I think I liked the individual part of it. I actually was a very keen soccer player. Mm-hmm. I loved playing soccer when I was growing up. I think that was probably more my passion than actually tennis was. But I used to go with my mom. She used to play it's called Tuesday League. And I used to go down, apparently I used to hit with her all the time. So I kind of always enjoyed the sport. But actually soccer was my real passion earlier on. But then, when I turned 13, 14, I think I liked the individual aspect of the sport. Going out, and I liked competing. I liked winning, obviously. It was a fun sport. And then once I started traveling around the world, I thought, oh, okay, maybe this is something I can do for a long time. I did enjoy that side of it as a youngster.
Yeah, Australia, there is similarities for us. I mean, we had our tennis court in the backyard also. And I mean, my mother played Tuesday midweek, Thursday midweek, Wednesday night competition tennis, Saturday afternoon. My dad played Saturday afternoon, Sunday morning. And then there was inter-district Sunday afternoons. I mean, growing up, there was so many competitions that we could play, and it was like an everyday affair. I don't know how any work ever got done in compared to these days. But tennis was certainly a very popular sport because we did have a lot of backyard courts throughout Australia. It was a real thing, and obviously I think as real estate became more expensive, people sold off their courts and sold their land. But I grew up in Illawarra where there was over 2,000 juniors. You know, it was certainly a thing. And what I remember about you specifically is you were, let's call you our demigod or mini god. You were the leader of our pack. I think you're a year older than me, but everyone looked up to Grant Doyle. I mean, you really led the way for so many. I think the best player I ever played in juniors was Alan Brelabragic, who I felt fortunate to get one game off. there's tennis and then there's tennis, and you seem to have picked up a real professionalism at a young age, which took you, into the Institute of Sport. Why don't you tell us a little bit about being part of the Institute and being part of Australian Junior, you know, at the elite level there?
Yeah, I think the Australian Junior Sport was really the catalyst that actually helped me go to another level. I remember I got invited when I was 15 years old. I, you know, to be honest, I wasn't really expecting to be invited at that point. Mm. But I got the invite, and you know, I remember the first year I was there. It was, you know, I had one of the best coaches in the world. It was Ray Ruffles at the time.
Yes.
When Ray was coaching, he's an unbelievable coach. So that gave me unbelievable, you know, I had already had a good foundation through other guys back in Sydney. Noel Callaghan was one. Mm. Brad Druitt, rest his soul.
He
was another one, and Mark Edmondson. So I had some really good coaches early on, but you know, for me, Ray was probably the best coach, one of the best coaches I've ever had. So you know, he really took me to another level quickly. I also had, you know, incredible guys to hit with. I had Todd Woodbridge, Jason Stoltenberg, you know, Richard Fromberg, you know, Johan Andersen, another guy who was phenomenal. Yeah. So you know, I think just hitting with those guys every day just made me so much better so quickly. And then you know, I was fortunate to have a good junior career and a really good start to my pro career, mainly because of them. Todd was always super helpful for me. Obviously, I know you grew up in Illawarra, and he was pretty close to that area as well.
He's around the corner from me.
Yeah, so he were always good friends and still are today. He helped me a lot. And Jason Stoltenberg, I consider a really good friend as well. He helped me a lot. Johan Andersen helped me a lot. I just had a great start, and I think they really helped me, especially early on in my career.
And so when you you know, you did get to number one junior in the world. I always like to throw that in there because, you know, it's no small feat. And I know that you were even young to achieve that. But from that crossover from juniors to into the major tour, talk us through a little bit about that and that transition, maybe some of the challenges you faced. Or some of the windfalls. I do remember, and I think I've mentioned this to you, you played Van Rensburg at New South Wales Open, and I think I was still a ball boy. and you beat him, and I thought, oh, my gosh, Grant Doyle's going to be, like, top 10 in the world. So tell us a little bit about that transition and that time for you.
Yeah, I look back on it now, and like I said, I had such a good start to my career, mainly from you know, being an institute of sport. But then, you know, I had a good start to my pro career, as you just mentioned as well. Mm. And I got up to, you know, around 200 in the world, you know, pretty quickly. And you know, I was starting to beat top 50 players. And I think, you know, unfortunately at that time, you know, Ray Ruffles was head left the Institute of Sport. He was gone. You know, I unfortunately didn't have the best advice at that point for furthering my career. So I feel like I kind of hit a wall transitioning. Once I got to 200 in the world, I didn't really have that connection with someone until about 3 years later. So I kind of, although I still maintained, you know, that ranking, I didn't really go anywhere, and I wasn't improving. And I had to take a good look at myself and understand why that wasn't happening. So I changed my team that I had around me. I had a new coach. His name was Anthony Lane, and he taught me to really start focusing on what was important and how I got to where I got to. And, you know, being number one in the world junior, I just remember, you know, him saying to me, you know, you don't really look like you enjoy the game. And I said, well, you know, I don't. There was, at that particular time, we were in a bit of a transition stage in Australian tennis. We had, you know, guys like Wally Masur and John Fitzgerald, who are obviously great players in their own right. But here I was, 18-year-old, and we didn't have anyone, I think, in the top 20 at that point. I think there was a lot of, you know, talk, like someone like you just mentioned, like, oh, he's going to be top 10 in the world, and he's going to be do this, and he's going to do that. I think I started to focus on the wrong things and focus on, well, I've got to do that. And I, you know, if I don't win every single match, I'm not going to get to that point. So I think I got lost. I got started focusing on the only thing that I thought was important was winning. Yes. I stopped getting better. I was going nowhere. I was just standing still. So if I look back on it now, I would have made a decision to change the team that I had around me, my coaching staff, a lot of other things that were around me, because I look back at it now and think that wasn't what I needed at that time. But at the same time, it also taught me a lot as well about what not to do. And I think I've been able to pass on that information and all the experiences that I had as a junior, and then getting up there quickly and then, you know, not progressing past that point to other people that I've worked with, you know, going forward. So, you know, I look at it as, well, I wish I had have, continue on the path that I was on, which is obviously, you know, to try to get to that top 10 level. But, I don't know if I ever could have made that level or not, looking back on it now. But I definitely feel like I could have been, you know, ranked higher for sure. But I look back at it now and I'm thinking, well, I was able to pass on information to other people and help them in their careers. So that also makes me feel pretty good about it.
Yeah, it's interesting. One of my last podcasts was, and I don't know if you know him, he's someone I've worked with, is Scott Arnold in the golf world, and he got to number one amateur in the world in golf. And we just had this discussion also, and it came down to the same thing, which is really interesting. It was like, who was kind of steering him at a certain time, and the advice or the lack of advice, if you will. And it's not to blame anyone, because obviously both of you had tremendous, tremendous ability. But it goes to show too, if you don't have good, sound advice around you or support, it's a lot of heavy lifting.
It's a little bit of, I had sometimes too much advice as well. Hmm. And I think if I had, looking back on it now, I should have just, in some of the people that were trying to, and they were legitimately trying to help me.
Yes.
Because we didn't have anyone, ranked high at in 1992. It was pretty sparse. We didn't have a lot of players ranked high. And so everyone was looking at me at being, the next guy to come through.
Yes.
I was getting a lot of help, but I should have had, looking back on it now, I should have had just a select few people that I, had on my team that I just listened to them and nobody else. I was kind of taking in everyone's advice and trying to almost make people, make people happy by taking their advice and doing, what they told me to do, instead of actually contemplating and listen and thinking about what they told me and then, either listening to it and doing it or throwing it out.
Got it. And then, like you were mentioning, let's call it your next career, which was moving into coaching. And that's when you and I started to become close. When you moved to the US, I was already living here, and there was a gaggle of us Aussies, which was fun. There was Brad Sini and Troy Budgeon. There was Oliver Schweizer, Anthony Ross. There was Brett Lucas down south. So there was a lot of us that were just around coaching. Talk us through kind of how you got into the coaching and what some of your thinking was as you trailed your way through tennis coaching.
Well, from a coaching point of view, I actually didn't really expect to be coaching when I decided to finish on tour. When I went to LA to catch up with Brad Sini, who I hadn't seen for a few years. He said, well, would you ever consider working here? And at that point, I didn't even consider coaching at all, to be honest. I'd already applied to go to school. I was actually, that's kind of what my mindset was, is that I always wanted to go back and get my degree and get into the business world. That's kind of where I was going to head with that. And then, I'm not sure what the time frame was, but it was about 6 months later I came back to the US and I won the green card lottery, which was totally by fluke. I was actually still, able to work in America, and I came back, and I did go back to school at a place called Moore Park College, because I had to start there, and then I was just teaching to make some money, to be honest, to pay for my school and to just live. in LA, which, as you know, can be pretty expensive.
Yes.
So, I was teaching quite a bit. I don't know, probably around 30, 35 hours a week. But then I was in school full time. So, and I loved it. I can honestly tell you, I didn't like school at all in high school. I honestly say I did not put in any effort. But you know, now that I had finished my tennis career, at least me playing, I love school. I couldn't wait to learn, and I really thoroughly enjoyed it. So, but about a year and a half later, I was coaching at a place called North Ranch Country Club in Westlake Village, and this big, tall, lanky kid came down to take a lesson. And to be honest, I didn't know him at all. And his name was Sam Query, and I talked to his dad, and his dad mentioned that he was, you know, I think top 10 in the country at that point for his age. And, would I coach him? And I said, sure, I could teach him a couple of times a week. And that's kind of how it all started. And we did that for probably a year and a half. And then after that period, that family asked me to work with him on a full-time basis. And so pretty much from 17 through 21, that's what I did with him. And, from there I moved to Austin, Texas. And that's where I worked with several players. Fritz Warmerans was one. Ryan Harrison, I worked with him for a couple of years as well. And I started some academies and a nonprofit school in Austin, Texas. And since then I've been back to Australia, and then now I live in San Diego. And I'm still coaching.
Well, there's certainly more to this story, but I appreciate the highlights. When you were starting to teach Sam, I mean, Sam, for our viewers and listeners here, Sam, I think his highest ranking now is probably 9, but I really see that you laid so much of the foundation, a lot of the things that, I don't know, Grant, maybe that hadn't been fulfilled in you, or the things that you knew that to transfer on, got an opportunity to share with him. Sam's obviously a very different personality than yourself, or we've all got our own personalities, and I end up doing some mental coaching with him thanks to you, and I try to help Sam in his early career look at decision, how he made decisions and what was wise, and he's had a tremendous career on the tour. And I think it hasn't been said that much publicly, but I've certainly spoken to his parents and Sam, and he said, I couldn't have done it without Grant. And so you're the backbone to a lot of young juniors who are looking to carve their way. And then how long were you in Albany over in the Bahamas there? What was that, 2 or 3 years?
Yeah, so Leighton Hewitt started a academy down there, and she called me up. I think it was around Christmas Day. I think it was around 2016, and said, "Have you thought about moving to the Bahamas?" And I was like, "Well, not really." And
I just made it to San Diego. I'm happy.
Yeah, exactly. And that's literally what I told him. I said, "No, I love being in San Diego. I kind of want to spend, the rest of my life here. I love it." And he said, "Well, I'm starting an academy down there, and I'd like you to get it up and running, and and see where we can take it." And so I said to him, I would spend, the next 2 years down there, and do that. And so I was down there for 2 years, and we had a really good start. I think at one point we had about 13 juniors from the Bahamas,
yes.
And we had about 8 or 9 kids from around the world in the high school academy that were living there full time. So yeah, we got off to a great start. Unfortunately, COVID has had a pretty bad effect, like every other business,
yes,
on it, but. I had a great time. I saw a lot of the Bahamas while I was down there, and yeah, it was a good experience. But you know, I have a daughter, and we always said we wanted to come back and have her start school in San Diego, and that's where we are today.
Yeah, and once again, I feel honored that you invited me down there, and I got to work with some of the tennis players and golfers, and it really is a world class facility that that gives a kid every opportunity, you know, to be good. I mean, from that eyesight, I think it was called eyesight, the technology that they used on court to track statistics of where you hit and all that. Was that what it was called?
Play site.
Mm-hmm. But also, you know, setting up the academy in Austin was a really big deal. You did that with Andy Roddick and his brother John, and the charity down there, and getting people through school. How many people did you have in that academy at one point?
When I originally started it, John Roddick was my partner, and then he moved and took the coaching job at University of Oklahoma about a year in. So then when he left, I started, obviously took the academy over by myself, and then I opened another one up in North Austin, a place called River Place Country Club. Mm-hmm. So I had two academies running, and then I also started a nonprofit school, which you know, I still say today that's one of the most rewarding jobs you know, I ever had. So I thought, you know, how it worked was a third of our kids didn't pay a cent to be there. Mm. A third of our kids paid half, and then a third of our kids were full paying students, and everything that we financially we had to raise to keep the school going. And but you know, the whole idea of it was to support kids who financially couldn't play the game. So you know, we did everything we could, and it was very successful. I think the first year we had four kids, mm-hmm. to start with, and then you know, we slowly built it up with the academies as well. And I think, you know, by the time I left, after about 6 years, we had 30 kids in the junior academy. We had 30 kids in the after-school academy. And then we had, I think, 108 kids in our nonprofit school. So, yeah, it was a lot of work. It was a lot of fun to do that. But it was very rewarding. And I think, you know, I learned a lot about education while I was down there.
Mm-hmm.
How it works, what works, what doesn't work, and you know, I learned a lot from a business point of view as well. So for me, that was, out of everything that I've done and you know, achieved, I think that for me was the most rewarding job.
I think what's interesting, I came down and visited you there also, and what I noticed very quickly is the sense of community that you and your family had put together. You know, it wasn't just you, of course, but you're leading the fold there. But there was a real sense of community. A lot of families were coming around to your place. They love being around you. You're a real focal point of the community, and to me, that says a lot about your character.
Well, yeah, my wife was actually very involved as well. She was doing a lot of the fundraising. You know, she was helping me a lot from the business point of view. Obviously, she's very established herself. You know, she's a lot smarter than me, which is good.
I was waiting for you to give her the credit so I don't get, you know, the backhand, you know, that's all.
No, it's just being truthful. She's a rock star. She is. She helped me a lot. So, you know, she was doing a lot of the work behind the scenes. And, you know, and she was maintaining a full-time job while she was doing all that. So, yeah, but we did. We, you know, we had a very, very good group of kids. You know, I loved being down there. It was a really good experience, and one I'll never forget.
And then after that, you went back to Australia. Is that correct? Back to Melbourne?
I did. At that point, you know, my wife and I, had just made a decision to, we wanted to see if we could, move back to Australia and see if we would like it, because we know my wife actually went to Penn State and then she graduated and then she's was living in the States ever since. So, you know, she hadn't been back to Australia in 20 years. Mm. So we both kind of made the decision to, if we're going to move back to Australia, this is kind of the time to do it. And it was funny, about a month after we had that conversation, I saw Todd Woodbridge at the US Open. He was running Tennis Australia at that point. And he literally asked me if I'd be ever interested in going back to Australia. And so anyway, one thing led to another. And about 4 months later, I moved back and started working for Tennis Australia at that point.
And what was that experience like?
It was great in a lot of ways. I met some really, really good people. I think, looking back on it now, I thought we had a really good system in place to create an environment as a federation to, bring up a lot of successful tennis players. Because when I moved down there, I think we were supporting overall around 80 athletes in Australia, and we dropped it to about 40. Mm-hmm. But a system we put in place was a system that wouldn't penalize kids that, weren't succeeding to the goals or, the ranking goals that we put in place. So mm-hmm. they wouldn't be punished. They were basically breaking even. But then if the kids are doing well, then they had the choice to either stay with us or they could go hire their own private coach at that point if they thought that was a better fit. So I felt like that was a really, really good system that my friend Scotty Draper, who was running Tennis Australia, Tennis Melbourne at that point, with a combination of other, professionals. Nicole Pratt was another one. She was running the women's side. Mm-hmm. And, Craig Tizer, who's obviously now working with Ashley Barty.
Yes.
He's been with her personal coach for a long time now. So there's a lot of good people down there, a lot of good tennis brains. So, yeah, I thought we had a really good system in place. So on that front, I thought it was great. I liked the job a lot. It's just I left simply because my wife got pregnant. so I, as you know, coming from Australia, it's very, very difficult to have a family and travel from Australia. It's so far away. And, when you leave, you're gone for anywhere between 3 to 8 weeks. And once my daughter was born, I really just didn't want to do it anymore. I thought that, I remember going away to my first trip away. It was about 6 weeks after she was born. Mm. And I went to South Korea. And we had a hotel reservation. I was traveling with Luke Saville mm-hmm. and another guy called Blake Mott at the time. And John Millman was also there. And there wasn't any hotel rooms anywhere to be seen. I booked two rooms, but they only had one room left. So naturally, I gave my room to Luke and Blake. And the same thing happened to John Millman. And so we were literally running around this city in South Korea, couldn't find a hotel room anywhere because they had it was a pre-Olympic meet that they had on. So all the rooms were open. So John and I literally that night end up staying in a very, very shady hotel that was very cheap. And I'll never forget it, walking up to the front counter and the guy handed me a condom.
Oh, wow.
So I looked in the mirror when I got into the room and just thought, yeah, this is probably not going to work for 2 months longer. So anyway, I finished that trip. And, after that, I didn't enjoy being away. I didn't enjoy the traveling as much, as what I did before. After my contract was finished, Tennis Australia, we moved back to San Diego and, I haven't regretted it one bit. We actually love it.
It's great to hear. And certainly there's not many people who have traveled the world, let's call it fortunate, or in some places like that, not so fortunate, because it can be a grind as a tennis player to travel so much. You know, you're doing it, at least 10 months of the year. And you did that for years and years and years. So I was fortunate enough when you were coaching to tag along a couple of years of that to some of the Grand Slams. But it really is something. Why don't you speak a little bit, Grant, to maybe people, young juniors who are interested to be on the tour? That's still their dream. They've got some ability. What would you propose to them? What advice would you have?
It's a long road. You have to be prepared to give everything you have. You've got to be prepared to sacrifice, having a normal life, because it is a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week job. You have to be training the right way. You have to have the right team around you. You've got to be eating the right way. You've got to be sleeping the right amount. You know, there's so many elements and different scenarios that you have to do. But at the same time, if you love the game, if you love traveling, you like, meeting new people, it's a very lonely sport, so you have to be prepared for that.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, if it's your passion and that's what you want to do, you should go for it. There's no reason why you can't be successful if you have the talent. The one thing that I wish someone told me, especially, even after having so much success as a junior, is that, no matter what happens, you're not going to win every week when you get to ATP Tour. You are going to lose matches. You're going to have situations where you do lose confidence. But at the same time, you can't put every single match, every single week, as a life or death situation. You have to be prepared to put in the hard yards and do it for a long period of time. You never know when your opportunity is going to come.
Right.
But when it does come, you've got to be prepared to take it with open arms. You have to be prepared the right way to be able to take it when it happens. But I wish someone had told me just have a little bit more patience, let the scenario play out. It never happens straight away. A very, very, very few people does it happen straight away.
Yeah.
You have to be willing to put in, like I mentioned before, probably a lot more work than what you think that you will have to.
Yes.
If I had it all over again, I wish I had been more patient. And, I just remember it took every loss, it kind of took away a little bit of my soul. And I think that was maybe because I won so much as a junior, I wasn't used to it.
Right.
I think for the first couple of years, that every match that I lost, and a little bit, also came from pressure from outside sources as well.
Yes.
Like I said, just took away a little bit of the enjoyment of the sport. Instead of trying to learn from it, just go out and what got me to that level was just go out and get better every day. Put in the work in the gym, put in the work in the track, do everything you can on a daily basis to get better. I think if you focus on that instead of focusing on, where you're going to be at the end of the year and worrying about things that are out of your control, I think that's, if I had to do all over, that's what I would do a lot better.
Mm. No, that's good. It's great advice. Do you have a highlight match that you recall, win or lose?
Yeah, I think I had several, but for me, my most probably enjoyable match, even though I lost, was I can't remember if it was quarters or semis, but it was in San Jose. It was a tour event, and I played Agassi.
Mm-hmm.
And, I didn't even play that great, to be honest. I think I was just so overawed by the situation, but he was number one in the world, and I was just happy to be out there. You know, especially going that deep in a tour event. But yeah, 14,000 people on the court, you know, watching. It was Valentine's night, playing at 9 p.m. on a, you know, it was a freezing cold February night. But you know, moments like that you never forget. Playing in front of people, you know, that many people, and just having a great time. I think, you know, I just, for me, I always I always generally played better when people were around, people were watching. It definitely motivated me. I definitely struggled at lower tier events to get up for matches when literally, you know, you got five people watching in the stands.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, good memories. I had a lot. You know, obviously playing, you know, Australian Opens are, a great memory, you know, playing at Wimbledon several times. You know, Wimbledon is obviously a very special place to play.
Yes.
But, you know, I think you just some of the locker room memories, some of the, you know, some of the jokes, some of the, you know, some of the games that we used to play. You know, I think you take it all in and you know, I don't think I have one special memory per se, but if I had to say one, I think it's probably, you know, playing against Andre when he was number one. That was a good experience.
Yeah, that's great. And for our listeners or for coaches who are developing players, is there anything you'd like you could share with coaches who are working on developing young juniors to either, you know, just play competition tennis, or they're interested in going to college, or they even further?
Well, I think, you know, you need to be clear on what the objective is to each player that you're coaching. You know, if someone wants to play college tennis, you're going to have to train them differently to someone who just wants to play high school tennis. And if someone wants to play professional tennis, you have to train them differently on top of that.
Yes.
But I think the biggest piece of advice I can give anyone for any coach is that you can never coach a player the same as you coach another player. You have to be flexible, and you have to be willing to sometimes change your own thought process on how to coach someone and what's best for that individual. Because how I teach Sam Querrey, for example, if I taught him the same as what I would, you know, taught Ryan Harrison, that wouldn't be the best scenario for Ryan Harrison.
Yes.
And if I taught Ryan Harrison the same way I taught Sam, there's no way that would be the best scenario for Sam either. So I think you've got to know your player. You've got to understand, you know, what makes them tick, how to get the best out of them, and it's never going to be the same. So there's no golden, you know, parachute per se that everyone, yeah, if I just do it this way, it's going to work for every single player. It doesn't work like that. You have to be flexible as a coach, and you have to adapt to whoever you're working with.
No, that's great advice. I think, you know, that starts to land in my world a little bit, which it's going to happen anyway, is, you know, the psychology of a person, but it's your own self-awareness, your awareness of others, how people learn, what makes them tick, you know, what's their motivation, where do they fall off, where's their depressions, you know, what's their surroundings. You know, I think a lot of I've worked with enough pros where it's often keeping life away from them, meaning the distractions, you know, the noise, if it's media, if it's, you know, a parent, a girlfriend, a boyfriend that is getting involved that can really put a lot of noise into their head. So it's interesting where the distractions do come from, where, you know, I think when you're starting out, you go, just, can I hit a good forehand? Can I hit a good backhand? You know, over and over again.
Oh, it changes dramatically, especially as they get better.
Yeah.
You know, there's just more people around. And similar what happened to me is that, and like I told you before, they're all trying to help, but I was getting advice from so many people, and I was just trying to make them happy instead of actually, you know, doing what I needed to do in order to get better. So, you know, because I had a lot of respect for the people that were giving me advice, you know, former, you know, Wimbledon champions were giving me advice. So, of course, you want to listen to everything they have to say.
Yes.
But at the same time, it's okay to actually, you know, respect what they say, but at the same time, maybe that's not the best situation for where you're at that particular time in your career.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's why I like to, when I was working with pros on tour, you know, I think whoever was around them, the team that was around them, was a very important piece of the puzzle, to keep them grounded and also to have them remember, you know, where they came from, who they are, what works for them, and what advice, you know, makes them tick, like I said before.
Yeah. Well, Grant, thank you so much for being my guest on this podcast. I send my love to Em and Ellie, your family. I miss you guys. It's been too long, but I am glad you're back in California. So it is a drive away. So let's catch up soon. And thanks again for sharing your wisdom, your knowledge, your experience with our listeners. I'm sure it's going to be really valuable for people who tune in.
Oh, I appreciate it. Always good to talk to you, Harry. You know how much we think of you. I hope to see you soon, mate.
All right. Very good. Thanks, Grant.
All right, bud.